This is David Bowman. I'm joined with David Ezrati, owner of The Next Wave, community activist, and congressional candidate. David, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, David.
A few questions today that we wanted to go over. First off, if you could tell the world only one thing about Dayton, Ohio, what would that be?
It's a great place to live.
Elaborate. What makes Dayton a great place to live?
There's a bunch of things, but cost of living is extremely low. Commute times are low. We've got great natural resources here in terms of, you know, we don't run out of water. You don't have to worry about, you know, am I going to take a shower in the morning? For me, that's really important. You know, the climate's pretty moderate. The people are friendly. There are all kinds of things to do here. And I think it's, you know, if you get out and really just wake up in the morning fresh and say it's a wonderful place, you know, a wonderful world we live in, and walk out and take a positive attitude towards Dayton, Dayton takes one back to you.
Next question, why run for Congress?
Well, I think that our political system isn't serving us well. I think it's sort of broken. And, you know, big part of what's broken is the communication process. The people who are being represented aren't able to communicate back to the people in D.C. what's going on. It seems like our voice has gotten lost. And that's what I do for a living, is I help companies find a voice to speak. And I think that, you know, getting the people to have their voice heard is, you know, what our founding fathers started out with. That was the idea. The whole process has gotten corrupted by big media, by big money. You look at these candidates and they have to raise $1 million every 2 years to run, and that's just insane, because the job only pays $160,000 a year. Anywhere else, you know, if David Bowman came to me and said, hey, will you give me $1 million so I can make $160,000, you know, a bank would turn you down flat. It's just a bad investment. But that's the way our system's working, and it's working that way because it's become corrupt. And I believe that with my profile, my notoriety for shaking things up, that there's a lot of people here who'd like to see things shook up in D.C. And I also think that, you know, I'm a first-generation American, and I love what I do. I love marketing. I love advertising. But beyond that, I love my country more. And there's nothing I could do that would make me happier, serve my country and serve the people of this community, to get the word out that, yes, we are innovators in Dayton, Ohio. We see the big picture. We're on the forefront. We believe in government that works for the people, as opposed to government that's, frankly, doing something else. So that's where it comes down to. You know, I had a lot of options in life. I've done different things, and they've led me to Dayton, and Dayton's been relatively good to me, and I want to be good back.
Okay. One of the things that is going to be important, I guess, to any American, but is gauging how what type of a job their congressional representative is doing. How, in your mind, do people measure the success of their elected officials, specifically their congressional representative? Frame that up, too, within the context of the current political state, where it's not easy to simply just come in and get things done. You've got a House divided, a Senate divided, a nation divided along a lot of senses. Speak to that, I guess. What's the gauge for success?
Well, it used to be the gauge for success was getting elected and getting reelected. However, that went out the door probably starting in the 70s or 80s when all this campaign money started coming in and just corrupting the process. I don't think most people think that who they elect makes a difference. And the reason I say that is because most of the people don't vote. We still don't. We have some of the lowest voting rates in the industrialized world. No other country in the world has such low turnout. And to me, that's really disappointing and sad. You know, if I hear one more time, well, I'm not registered to vote because I don't want to serve on jury duty. Well, you know, we got to do something to fix that, because, you know, if we don't have people serving on juries, the whole system doesn't work either. But success for me in this race, what I would consider success, is to take on a guy who's got $750,000 already stashed away in the bank from special interest groups, and to beat him like a rug with spending 200,000 or less. Ideally, no more than 160,000. I mean, that would be success to me, because it would be sending a message not just to Mike Turner that, you know, his vote shouldn't have been for sale, but to people all over the country that this can happen, that we can say it's time to throw these special interest groups and lobbyists out the door and take our country back. So we'll see what happens.
With your campaign specifically, it's just gotten underway not too long ago. You've been heavily leveraging technologies such as YouTube, blogs, other forms of social media, using that, it's sort of cutting edge political campaigning. We saw some of that in the last presidential campaign with Howard Dean and some of the grassroots things he did. Certainly a lot more this time around, but talk about the future of technology as it pertains not only to the electoral process, but to the political process in general, and greater accountability, greater communication, etc.
Everybody remembers when they were asking John Kerry, he says, well, I voted for it before I voted against it, before I voted for it. You know, and the record that we have of these things is through tapes from C-SPAN and from, you know, how they voted and such, but we never got to hear what he was thinking that day. You know, he went to vote today and he had to vote on something, and, you know, every one of these is a balancing act. It's not black and white. It's not easy. They managed to, you got to weigh out what's good and what's bad and compromise on every single vote. So what was he thinking at that time? Well, we won't know. But I guarantee if someone like me is elected and I'm blogging every day what I voted on, why I voted on, not just to share the information, but to get feedback from my constituents about how they feel about this. And, you know, before and after. I mean, I can ask the questions before. I think they'll see that there's a whole new way that we can bring transparency to government. And I think it's going to change the way we elect people. You know, when the whole thing started out, people were elected more like in the caucus. And it was, you know, you'd meet in town hall and everybody knew each other. And they say, oh, Ben Franklin, yeah, Ben's a good guy. We know Ben. We're going to send Ben to be our representative. And it was only a part-time job. You know, you'd go to the state house or you'd go to D.C. to meet in session, and then you'd come back. It wasn't a full-time job. It wasn't day in, day out. You know, you go and do the business of government, you come back and you were a printer. Now these guys are full-time politicians with these huge staffs. And realistically, it's gotten way out of whack. And I think by having that communication process open and easy, things will change dramatically. And I think people will start looking at your record over time of what you said and what you thought and how well you responded to issues and how well you shared the information as the basis on how they pick candidates. In the same way that, you know, we know Ben Franklin, well, they'll know David Osrati pretty well after 2 years of reading what I do when I'm elected. So
what big ideas do you hope to not only propose, but maybe more importantly to accomplish? Big difference between the two.
Yeah. You know, I'll be a junior congressman. I'll be one of 435. It's very hard to get anything done. Okay? Mike Turner can take credit for all kinds of things, but trust me, he did not save Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. He did not make BRAC happen. He did not, you know, these earmarks are a bad thing. I wouldn't be proud of all this pork. That's our money coming back here. I don't know what people get so excited about. You know, I give you $100 and you give me 10 back. Ooh, I'm happy? No, I don't think so. Those are our tax dollars, and they've been squandered pretty good for a long time. But the big ideas, and these aren't things that I just came up with since my candidacy, because I've been putting these big ideas up for 3 years or more. I don't know. That's how you and I met. You know, but I write these things as they come to me. And, you know, obviously the first big idea is that proving that the system doesn't have to be borked by the big media, you know, where you have to buy your way into office, as John Edwards says. I thought we're running an election, not an auction, you know, and I'd like to put a real election back in there. But other big ideas, one of the things that irks me is when one community fights another community for economic development. Well, government is not supposed to be messing around in business. I'm taking more of a libertarian stance here. But, you know, when the city of Dayton intervenes to try to help cite a Kroger, it says to me, you're not doing the other stuff you need to be doing, like sweeping the streets, policing the streets, enforcing housing code, etc. You've got your eye off the ball. The ball is providing those services that we all need. That Kroger, that's not serving the whole city. That's serving a very small segment of the city. And it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of effort. I want government out. And you know, I give that very specific example, Kroger in Dayton. But let's take the Reynolds and Reynolds company move out to Kettering. Kettering's offering them tax abatements. Dayton's offering them tax abatements. They're fighting amongst each other, and at the end, the only people that lose are the taxpayers. The CEO walked out of there with only 2 years, and he walked out with $9.1 million. You got laid off in that process. I mean, it's insane. It's corporate welfare. It's absolutely got to stop. No state to no state. I don't care where you want to locate. You don't get any tax breaks. You pay the same rate everywhere. And it's fair, equal, and level playing fields. You don't have level playing fields, it doesn't work. It starts getting corrupted, just like our political system. That's got to stop. So the only tax credit I want to give business, the only one, is one based on you can walk to work. Your employees walk to work, you get a tax credit. So you want to relocate someplace, you locate someplace close to where your employees live. So there's not this dependence on foreign oil. So you don't have people hopping in their cars every time to drive, and then you got to have room to store the cars and everything. Because, face it, people, one of the reasons this country's having financial difficulties is because we got to pay somebody for our oil. And the people we're paying aren't playing, and they don't really care about us. So this idea of eliminating corporate welfare and just moving to a simple tax credit system based on walk to work is a big idea. It's something I think is game-changing. Because right now, all of our governments are going, you know, state, county, municipal, they're all running out of money. And the reason they're running out of money is they've been doing these games. They've been spending all their energy focused on trying to bring business instead of just doing what's right for the people, and the business will follow. So that's one. Another one was this one's a little more specific, but hub zones. Are you familiar with what a hub zone is?
Vaguely.
Historically underutilized business zones. The SBA has designated them. They're all mapped out. It's all done through this great database crunching through the census. And these are poor areas. These are poor areas that need investment. And the SBA has these set aside for SBA, for hub zone certified businesses. And it's a special set aside, but the amount of money going into it's nothing. It's not going to change things. It's not going to make the poor parts rich. So there's also this incredible shortage of H-1 visas. H-1 visas are the ones you want to give the PhD candidates and doctors and, you know, really smart people who want to come to this country and work. But they all want to go work in places that are booming, bustling, where there's, you know, already, they're going to get paid well. And like it or not, this country does need immigration in. We're going to be in a world of hurt. We're not going to have anybody do any work here pretty soon if we don't, because we're not making babies fast enough. Now, that's a whole other story. But the H-1 visa process is so clammed up, there's like a backlog of 750,000 people every year trying to get these visas. Google wants to hire all these people. They can't. They can't bring them in. So I'll say, okay, you can bring as many H-1 visas as you want as long as you locate your business in the hub zone and these people live in the hub zone. Talk about instantly. Places like my part of Dayton, which is a hub zone, would have things being built, jobs being created and everything, as opposed to them building something more in Silicon Valley. Simple solution, marrying two problems, solving them both, boom, nice and easy. It's that kind of thinking. Those are the kinds of things that I think I can bring to the table. Plus, if I can teach a few more politicians how to get elected without spending $1 million, I think we're on the right track to bringing democracy back to the people.
Your opponent in the election, Mike Turner, long history here in the city of Dayton and in the area. I think you on your site have said a lot of things that he has done wrong. Out of maybe a point of curiosity for anyone listening to this, give me something he's done well. Sincerity, something he's done well. I can see the joke already coming.
He got elected.
Well, He's been very good at doing that.
And you know, the funny thing is I voted for Mike Turner this very first time, even though when I was in that race, I ran against him and Clay Dixon or Jim Sweeney. I came in fourth out of six. That was my very first race. I saw Mike Turner on a day-to-day basis, and I learned what kind of a person he was. And so that biased me for a long time. But beating Clay Dixon was a huge achievement, and, you know, it needed to happen because Clay Dixon wasn't going to take us anywhere, and Mike didn't really take us anywhere, but he did bring it, you know, a sense of taking us somewhere. And when people say, oh, yeah, he did take us places, well, no, to take us places, he would have had to build a team that worked with him and grew. Real leaders, you know, they have somebody in there stepping behind them that can step in when they leave. He didn't do that. They can build support and network. He couldn't do that. He couldn't get anybody else elected. When he tried, it was an absolute failure. So, you know, what did he do right when he was mayor? Well, he did pass one initiative that I thought was really strong, which was that when you tear down a building, you can't just tear it down, bulldoze it into the basement, and leave the site. That's not progress. That's just creating a mess for somebody else. And so he made that illegal. It cost some people some money. It probably made the guys who do the demolition a little more money because they had more to haul off and more to charge in the backfill and everything, but it was a good thing. It meant that in the future we'll have buildable sites instead of something you got to excavate first and then build. But realistically, you know, since he's been there, he's been going on his fifth year, getting the word God added to the flag certificates is not really a real achievement. I haven't seen, and you know, the problem is none of them have done that much, so we're not getting anywhere. And I know Mike Turner pretty well. I know his aversion to openness and honesty because he had me arrested. He's an attorney. He took all that training. He supposedly knows the Constitution inside out and the laws of our land, but he lost to me five times in court. And I just don't think people that can't figure out the basic ideals of free speech should be the people speaking for us in D.C.
This is similar to the first question I asked at the beginning of the interview, but probably a little more broad. What in your mind is right with Dayton? This probably is more than the first question about what's great about Dayton, and maybe more specifically with the workings between the private sector, the public sector, the political sector. What's working well? There's plenty of examples of things that aren't working well that we could point to, but what is working well?
For everyone, that was Dave dropping his pen cap because he's fidgeting. not me. Anyways, I'm enjoying this. There are some things about Dayton that work really well. Sinclair Community College works incredibly well. I've got to say that it's probably been one of our most valuable assets. We have the ability to train a workforce inexpensively, to adapt, to change. They've done a great job at adding programs that the community needs. So we've got that. We've got, you know, it's the old 90-minute market bit, but, you know, the intersection of 70 and 75 just can't be beat. It's a great location for distribution. When you realize that at one point we had the Emory Hub here and DHL is real close by in Wilmington, you know, it doesn't matter what your business, you can get stuff to somebody overnight and anywhere in the world. I mean, it's just phenomenal. DHL is, you know, you can drive your truck there at 2 a.m. and the stuff still gets out and gone. So, do I think we missed having the hub at the airport for Emory? Yeah, but, you know, we'll see what happens. Dayton has lost a lot of its perceived edge. And I believe that we still have a workforce here that is very competent. I believe there are people here that can do a very good job. I also believe we've actually got a pretty good scientific community here, thanks to the base, Wright State, UD, that's totally overlooked. It's like a secret in the closet that just doesn't get out. We don't get looked upon as a brain trust. And part of that is, you know, we have a newspaper that reads like USA Today. It's as dumbed down as it gets. I long ago suggested they start publishing the patents that are awarded in the area on a regular basis. I saw this in Austin. I thought it was a great idea. I made the suggestion. Of course, they didn't follow up. But there's a lot of stuff happening here, a lot of inventions, a lot of startups, a lot of small innovation that's just untapped. And, you know, if we ever get some sort of regional leadership, and, of course, if global warming hits and, you know, Miami and New York are underwater, we're going to have some prime business properties here.
Coastal real estate at the intersection of 70 and 75.
Right. I don't know. But, you know, there's a lot of good people here. It comes down to people. And once, if we could all get our drum beating together for once and not bickering, I agree a lot with what, you know, Bill Pote is doing on Dayton Most Metro. And I love Teresa Gasper and her all rah-rah, and this idea of the creative class thing is, it's going to be a bit of a hard sell because we've still got a blue-collar community here, a work ethic that's a little different. And it might not be the right fit, but if government would get out of the way and just do government right and stop stepping all over itself, I think the business community could step forward. But it's still hard to do business here. It's still, sometimes we get in the way. I mean, this whole intervention in the Kroger thing is just another example of, you know, government was doing its job, this would be, it would get done no matter what. They'd spend whatever it took to get the deal closed, it would have gotten closed. But it just, we're not feeling strong, we're not feeling secure in our investing here.
I think a good part of your answer leads into my next question, which is more on a regional basis. To the east, you've got Columbus. It's not too far from Springfield until where Springfield Dayton stops and Columbus starts. You're talking about 20 minutes of cornfields. To the south, you've got...
we don't have any cornfields anymore.
Cornfields are gone. You've got basically the... It's all coming together, really, Dayton.
Right.
And I saw Jeffrey on Daytonology yesterday reference the term Daytonatty.
Well, that's been around for a while. That's not
apropos. But talk about Dayton's role in the broader region as it pertains to Cincinnati, Columbus. What makes Dayton different? What makes Dayton special? And not only how does it survive, but then how does it work with the other two larger cities to add value to the three?
Well, I'm a big proponent of high-speed rail. I don't know if I'll ever see it in my lifetime, but I think it's something that needs to happen badly between Columbus, Cincinnati, and Dayton. I think those cornfields are going to be more important than we could ever have thought, and we're going to really regret a lot of this sprawl, which is another reason for that, you know, the tax credit only for walk to work and to stop this stuff, because when you get right down to it, we all got to eat, and we need, everything's pretty much based on corn, believe it or not. And if we don't start looking long term at the, you know, when the cost of shipping that corn goes up, goes up, goes up, we're going to wish we had cornfields in our backyards again. And, you know, Columbus has their act together. It's booming, it's hopping, it's bustling. Cincinnati, you know, they've got things going on. It's happening. It's definitely weathering the financial turns a lot better than Dayton is. Dayton's got some serious work to do, and it's not going to happen if we don't get some leadership that sees the big picture. And I've seen an awful lot of attempts at working together that just, you know, it's all lip service. And these next 10 years are going to be really critical. I'm worried about Dayton's future. I don't see we're losing our leadership. A lot of the people that I knew that I thought would be great leaders have just, you know, abandoned the city. And I don't just mean Dayton proper. I mean, they're living in Florida. They're living in Seattle. They're living in San Diego. I mean, population losses in Ohio, we're going to lose 2 seats in the House, they're saying, in the next census. I could be one of those if I don't do some things to help turn this around. It's, you know, Columbus and Cincinnati are not going to look out for our best interests. We got to look out for our own. And I had high hopes for some of the people like J.P. Nassif, but he's become really more of a politician than anything. And I don't see things emerging that are going to change the way we do things. If we don't change, we're going to die. I mean, that's just the way it goes. Everything's evolving, and we haven't been evolving very well.
What do we bring to the table in the context of the three cities? What is it that's unique that Dayton brings to the table that the other two can't?
We're going to have
besides the base, which is obviously.
You know, we've got the base. We've got some large manufacturing facilities that might not be filled soon here if things don't turn around. Sinclair is still, you know, the ability to train people. We have office buildings that can be had for a song. I mean, if you're looking to open up something like a call center, it's just unbelievable how cheap you can find space here. That's not how I want to be competing in the future. But when you look at cost of real estate, Dayton's a bargain compared to either Columbus or Cincinnati. If you're talking cost of living, it's a bargain. So, you know, if we have to pick up the discount leftovers, that's what we're going to have to do until we figure out something else. I have made proposals for things that I think would change the perception, change the field, like Sportsplex down the whole McCall area, the McCook Field area, and Parkside Homes, and people just can't see the vision. Instead, they're pursuing more of the same, and it's, frankly, I don't think that's going to work. Hate to be a pessimist here towards the end.
All right, then I'll give you something to be optimistic about. Okay. Talk about the things Bob Schiffler's doing.
Bob Schiffler's single-handedly able to do what, you know, a bunch of other people haven't been able to do. He's graced with some resources that, you know, that the rest of us don't have accessibility to. And the other thing about him, he seems to be able to stay frugal,
yeah,
which is something that I think you have to do urban reclamation. I think, I did my four properties, and then I did another one, and the key is doing it yourself. And he's an example of that do-it-yourself attitude. He's made it fun to go through into a building, and it's just that kind of extra value add is what it takes. You know, that's marketing, that's vision, that's making a statement, that's doing things that make people feel good. And I've got to hand it to him. You know, he's bringing a lot there. He's moving at a pace where I think he can keep doing it for a while, but when he gets to the arcade, he's going to need some other people to help him. That's a big elephant to chew on. So, I'm happy to see people like Bob take over, and I, you know, it's kind of sad the Dayton building. He's bailed on downtown, but their new building's phenomenal. It's going to work really well. I was really bummed they tore down the old garage. I didn't think that really was an improvement over the parking lot they have now. I mean, big mistake there, but I think Schiffler will take all that, and it'll become a hub again sooner or later of happening cool hit places.
How do you get more Bob Schifflers to come to Dayton, if there is such a thing? He's such a unique guy. He's so low-key but so talented at the same time. Very focused on what he's doing. How do you get somebody else like that?
You could have a lot of Schifflers here if the city made it easier to work. I'm sure if you sit there and ask Bob Schiffler, he'll be very gracious about it, but he's had his times where he probably just wanted to nail somebody to the wall in City Hall about, look what I'm trying to help you here, and you're not getting it. And we don't have people down there that are getting it, and we don't have people that are holding their feet to the fire. Little shop I noticed, the woman was down on Fifth Street. She's moving to Brown Street, and she's like getting these 11-page documents citing Ohio Revised Code on a 900-square-foot shop. It's like, come on, people. You know, I'm sorry. You might be following the letter of the law, but it's killing us here, especially if you're talking about renovating. It got to the point where it was so hard to reuse things, you know, with all the building code requirements. I went through that with this building. It took me 9 months to get an occupancy permit. you know, they were talking about these crazy things about having lighted exit signs over the door. So I'm like, the doors have windows in them. If you can't figure out it's a door and it leads to the outside, and there are four of them on the first floor, this building is not that big, you can't figure out it's a door and how to get out without the word exit above it, you deserve to be out of the gene pool. I tried to explain it to them. They finally, you know, okay, we understand it would look really stupid, but, you know, it is the law. I'm like, it was the law for a hallway with a bunch of doors that all look the same, where you need to be able to figure out how to get out. We don't even have to turn the lights on in the day here. I mean, there's windows in every room. You can pick up a chair, throw it through the window, and you can get out. But no, we need exit signs. So you make it easier, and they will come,
yeah.
And they will do these things, and they will have fun doing them, but... I mean, hello, a little grocery up here, trying to open up. They were being told about how they had to have a handicapped accessible bathroom, even though they didn't have to have a bathroom for the public because they're not big enough. And, you know, there were bathrooms there and they were existing, but no, we had to knock. It cost $9,000 extra dollars to knock a wall out and make a handicapped accessible bathroom. Stop!
Does it come down to making common sense more common practice? I guess it's the phrase.
Well, common sense is a lost art in this country. I mean, common sense says it shouldn't cost $2 billion to run an election. It shouldn't cost you $1 million to run for a... Turner and McGlynn spent over $1 million on the mayor's race, and it pays $36,000 a year. What's wrong with this picture, people? When Turner ran the first time, Clay Dixon had $27,000 in the bank, and people thought that was outrageous. In fact, when I brought it up, Dixon got so mad he took me outside, tried to beat me up. You know, that all disappeared. I mean, those days are long gone.
How is a political campaign different from an ad campaign?
In advertising, if you lie, you get sued. Political campaigns, you lie, you get elected. That's how it's different. If I could advertise the way that politicians do, I could sell anything.
There you go.
So that's your answer. That was an easy one.
One of your heroes is advertising legend David Ogilvy. So in the spirit of the WW bracelets that I see and whatever, what would Ogilvy do? WWOD.
Well,
if he were running your campaign.
If he was running my campaign, he'd be kind of having trouble because he died in 1999 and it was before the internet really took off. And in his last books, you know, in his classic Ogilvy on Advertising in 84, he still hadn't gotten his head around television yet. He was really a print guy. But Ogilvy thought that a good headline and, you know, explaining the benefits of the product in a way that, you know, your mother could understand were real important. So he wouldn't stand for these little soundbite type things or the literature that comes out and says, you know, hi, I've got a wife and a kid and I went to this school and I was born in Dayton, so you should elect me. He'd find one issue and he would talk about that issue in that ad. One issue only, and it would be in depth enough that you could understand it and make the sale. So I've been trying to focus on that. I've been focusing on this auction versus election. Who's your representative? You know, slowly, first we talk about how much money it takes and how big media won't like me and how, because they thrive on this. And they're sending me letters, oh, talk to us about advertising with us. I'm like, no, I don't want to advertise with you. I don't want to have to raise that kind of money and sell out to special interest groups. So, you know, the first ad was about big media. The second ad was about who's representing you, and I used the Priceless campaign. You know, it comes down to, I've got to do ads that people want to watch because I'm not paying to intrude into their house. And David Ogilvy also felt, you know, don't insult people. It should be invited in. So I'm working on that. I'm following along, but I'm buying the media. It just seems like a bad investment. So I'm doing my best to keep true, but the main thing is my ads are absolutely authentic and they're real, and yeah, I did them, or I'm in them, or I wrote them. There's nobody doing it for me. I was sitting at the Dayton Daily News editorial board yesterday, and Jane Mitikaitis hired a Washington, high-powered Washington, D.C. pollster to tell her she could win in Ohio 3. Don't you have anything better to spend your money on, Jane? Can't you tell? If the economy's stupid, people are losing it. The sheriff is the largest home seller in Montgomery County. That's not the way it's supposed to be, folks. He's putting real estate agents out of work. So, you know, anyways, that looks like the last of David's questions.
Any closing remarks for me? And for the general public at large?
Well, thank you for listening to this podcast and making it all the way to the end. It just says you either have a long commute or a long run or nothing better to do, or that we're just having a scintillating conversation here. And I hope David takes the time to transcribe this whole thing so you can find it in the search engines, because that's always good. I don't think he's going to do that. But at least he'll try to write it up so you can find
it. I'll give you the audio.
He'll give me the audio. Let me try it. You know, this getting involved anymore shouldn't be just sending a check. It shouldn't be, you know, putting a yard sign out. It should be actually, you know, going and digging into who's running, taking a look at it, making your own choices. And it better be straight from the horse's mouth. I don't think you can. I think I'm turned off when I hear these polished answers with these soundbite clips and the. I want to know what the real deal is. I want to hear everything. I want authenticity over the sizzle. And I think, you know, by listening to this, you, the listener, have shown that you care more about what's going on. And hopefully you'll say, hey, I want to go to his site, which is, of course, esrati.com, ESRATI.com, and look into this and say, look at what he's been saying, not just now that he wants to get elected, but over the last 3 years. And does this not sound like the kind of guy? And look at how the feedback and the comments and look at the relationships that are being built and say, yeah, I think this works better than the way the other ones work. My two competitors don't even have sites up right now. One has one up that's 2 years out of date. One doesn't have anything up. And, you know, Turner, of course, has his congressional site and he's got his campaign site. And none of them are, it's all about chest beating, all about me. That's not what the answer is anymore. It's about you, about representing the voter. And I'm just 180 degrees from all these people. And I hope I've made it clear to you that it's worth it to vote for me. And if you want to help out, get on the website and tell your friends about it. And volunteer if you'd like, or send money if you have to. We do need money to send the mailing out, but I really appreciate you listening in on this, and I think that's informed public is absolutely critical to getting elected. I thank David for taking his time to do this, and for, you know, all these years of being online there together and trying to change the marketing community of this town, because I think that's both of us have higher expectations for our craft and our city, and that's what keeps us to be mutual friends and what's kept us going all these years. So, thank you.
Thank you, David. I unfortunately can't vote for you because of where I live, and I also can't vote for any of your competitors, so I am here as a objective reporter, journalist.
Woo!
I think it's going to be a fascinating campaign to follow. Whether you're into politics or not, I think it's something you're going to want to pay attention to, because clearly you're trying to do something that's very different from how campaigns have been run before, and it will be interesting to follow as it gets closer to election day, and to see how the back and forth goes and how it plays out in what really is going to be sort of the dawn of a new age of politics in my mind. So I'm looking forward to seeing you out there fighting the fight, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.